and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
That's right, it's WBAI in New York, Monday night, 10 p.m., and in typical fashion, we are awaiting the late Mike Sargent to deliver up this evening's program. So, I don't know, what am I going to do? What I'm going to do is switch back to the other goddamn blessed computer and present to you, until such time as Mike delivers a program, a fundraising appeal from Night Shift.
How does it feel?
It feels like times have changed.
It is always appropriate to be here. Contemplate. If you ever happen to be someplace and you contemplate, I'm not here, where are you? So in this moment, be here. Be here wherever here happens to be. In this day and time, we have gathered together to contemplate, to dialogue this that is called...
I'll be damn late.
Now, where are my people? 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 Where are my people?
right, and you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. I am Mike Sargent, and this is Night Shift. And this, as you heard in our little mini-intro, is going to be continuing in what I call the 30th anniversary celebration. The fact that Night Shift has been on for 30 years, which is still mind-numbing because I'm only 39. But going back and listening to these shows is like going back and revisiting, you know, a past, a life, my life, the life of the show, all the people I interacted with. And going back, as I mentioned, I found all these interviews. And okay, so I'm going to tell you who I'm going to play interviews with. First, I did two interviews with him. I did one like in one decade and one and then like 15 years later.
Okay,
with Andy Summers. The same Andy Summers. Okay.
Oh, stop.
Yes. So I did a whole special on Andy Summers, which I'd forgotten about. And Andy Summers, if you don't know who Andy Summers is, he was one of the original members of the Police. I say the original members, there were only three. And it was Sting, Andy Summers, and Stuart Copeland. And Andy Summers was the guitarist.
And also, he was, in the 90s, he was the, for the first season, he was the band leader for the Dennis Miller show.
Yes, he was. That's right. Yes, he was. You know, and what's crazy is, for me, is I remember vividly the first time I met Andy Summers. He came to my apartment. This is back when I was living in Midtown Manhattan, and I would have people, I had all these people come to my apartment. Fred Williamson came to my apartment. Andy Summers came to my apartment. All these people. So, but it was, you know, I was in Midtown, doorman. Yes, come on by, Fred. Anyway, so yes, I have an interview with Andy Summers, which was great because we hadn't seen each other in whatever, like 10, 15 years. And so there was a catch-up. So it was really interesting. He had a lot to say about being a guitarist and what it meant to him and what it was like for him to actually get a guitar. So do you have any particular memories or thoughts on Andy Summers' music? Because he went off and did solo stuff with a label called Private Music. This is back in the late 80s, early 90s when New Age music was a thing.
Yeah. I'll be completely honest. I do love Andy Summers. I think he's fantastic. But in terms of his solo stuff, I'm a lot more familiar with Stuart Copeland's soundtracks.
Interesting.
Ridiculous or amazing. He did one for, what is it, Men at Work?
Oh, he did.
And,
he did a number.
He did a British film that escapes me right now. I think it was a, not Mike Lee, the other director who does these sort of independent films. This was like an early 90s. Robert Carlyle is in it. He plays a builder. I can't remember the name of his film.
Okay.
But he did the soundtrack for that.
Yes, well, he did do a number of films, and especially in the 90s, he was doing a lot of soundtracks, did a lot of TV, too.
The film was called Riff Raff, I just remembered that.
All right, that's the film you think of? Yes, okay. Well, I definitely like Stuart Copeland, but I liked Andy Summers quite a bit, too, and I liked Sting. I liked all of them. They all did interesting things as solo artists, I thought. I know, you know, Stuart Copeland had done The Rhythmatist, and he was going around exploring rhythms around the world, which is something I think a lot of drummers do, like Peter Gabriel and even Phil Collins explored that a little bit.
So,
I'm going to play first with Andy Summers, but then I have interview with George Miller.
Stop.
Yes. Okay, George Miller. And George Miller for Happy Feet 2. Okay. So, yeah, so Happy Feet 2. Happy Feet. It was surreal. It's what's surreal is listening to him, like, now he's got this film coming out now, 3,000 Years of Longing.
Right.
So it's a good time to play the George Miller interview.
And isn't he right now already working on the
spinoff, the Mad Max spinoff with the female Mad Max, the young Furiosa character that Charlize Theron played in the last Mad Max film. So it's a prequel, how Furiosa becomes Furiosa.
Anya Taylor-Joy, correct.
So I have that interview with George Miller, but the other interview that I want to talk about that I'm going to play, besides George Miller, is Bill Nighy.
Oh, God.
Yes. Now, Bill Nighy, because I did now the second show, well, not Hitchhiker's Guide. He did a film called Arthur Christmas, and he played Grandpa Christmas, old crotchety St. Nick, and he's, of course, great. And for me, just the chance to talk to Bill Nighy is, if you don't know who he is, just he's such a great... His voice is great. It's a night shift interview with Bill Nighy. So I have George Miller, Bill Nighy. I also have the screenwriter for the film Arthur Christmas. So that'll be the second show that I play towards the end of the evening, the second half of the show. And that show is from November of 2011. It seems like an eternity ago. That was, I think, Obama was president then. It was like, it seems like a different time. Especially, you know, I was reading this article today about how out of the 87 people who the GOP have supported in this coming election, okay, have chosen to be the candidates, 54 of them are
they're
election deniers. And the fact that election deniers is a term.
Right.
Life is like science fiction part of it. It's like, exactly. They are election deniers. It's like elected officials, people who are running for office who are elected, who are election deniers, who have people that will vote for them. Not to mention the party itself does. Anyway, the whole thing is surreal and post dystopian. No, I say pre-dystopian, I should say. We're not post-dystopian. We'll, you know, I don't know if we'll live. Well, no, we're heading to dystopia. Dystopia will last for a while because, well, you just got to look at history to know how long dystopia will last. Because if you really think about history, okay, for certain peoples, especially brown peoples, it was a dystopia. America was a dystopia. Always was, if unless, you know, you were a quote-unquote settler. A white settler. So, Mike from Jersey, or as Danny calls you, MFJ.
I want to do that from now on. I'll be MFJ like a rapper.
MFJ. So, MFJ. All right. Well, we're gonna go right now into the Andy Summers interview, and I talk about another interview that I'm not gonna play there because there's another interview I also had in that show. Which is also a great interview. But this is as Max taught me to say, this is an encore presentation of a past night shift show from the 30th anniversary we're celebrating. This show was originally aired, I believe, in 2012. And I think the interview was a little bit before that. I have to look at what was going on. But it is long ago, you know, sometime in the late second decade of Night Shift. And then we're going to come back, and I'll give you a little bit of a heads up for the Bill Nighy, George Miller interview here on Night Shift.
When I got the guitar at about 12 and a half years old, it was like destiny, right there, right in my hands. You know, that I never looked up from that guitar again, and still haven't, basically.
Позвоните в милицию. Позвоните в милицию.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. And this is the Night Shift Music and Film Special. I have an interview this evening, or this morning, depending on how you look at it, with Andy Summers, Alexandre Desplat, and a few surprises. So please, sit back, stay tuned, and enjoy Night Shift, Night Shift, Night Shift, Night Shift, Night Shift. Their music's so iconic and memorable, I don't think, whether you're a fan or not, you wouldn't know who they were, and that's The Police. I got a chance to sit with the guitarist from The Police. You know his work better than you think. You know his sound, because it is definitely a big part of what made The Police The Police. Andy Summers's been with The Police from the beginning, and he's got a new documentary that he has made, which is based on his book. The documentary's called Can't Stand Losing You, and it's a documentary not just of Andy Summers and his time prior to The Police and then joining The Police and then the subsequent breakup with The Police, but also about the reunion tour that came about 20 years after they had broken up and what that was like. Seeing the documentary is very, very enlightening. It really gives you an insight to how the band works, the dynamics of the band, probably a pretty good idea as to how and why they broke up, who the main architect of that was, and without giving too much away, it's really a behind-the-scenes look at how a rock and roll band or a super band or very successful musicians who may or may not have outgrown what they've done are able to come back together and do what they did and what made them famous. Andy Summers, for me, has been someone whose music I followed mostly after The Police. I like The Police as much as anybody, and I enjoyed everything that they did, and I had friends who were much more into The Police than I was, but there's no denying how talented they were. Most people know all the things that Sting did after The Police, and a few people may know what Stuart Copeland did after The Police. Stuart Copeland went on to score several movies, most notably The Outsiders and Rumblefish for Francis Ford Coppola, and he did several of his own solo albums, the most notably The Rhythmatist, the result of a pilgrimage he took to Africa, and it features local drums and all percussion, which again was a big part of The Police sound, where we got a chance to see what interests Stuart Copeland. Sting, we've gotten a chance to see with the jazz and the type of music that he's done since he left the band, but Andy Summers falls into a different category, mostly instrumental. After his first solo album, which came out in 1987, was called XYZ, and it was really pretty much his only non-instrumental album that he's done, and it really didn't do well on the charts. He went from there to go to private music, and the subsequent scores he did for 2010, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Weekend at Bernie's, and a few others. He did books, he exhibited photography, and he was briefly the musical director on the short-lived Dennis Miller Show. Over the years, he collaborated with everybody from Robert Fripp, even went back to perform and be on Sting's second album, Nothing Like the Sun, and then invited Sting to come back and play on his album, Charming Snakes, and doing some vocals on Summer's tribute album to Thelonious Monk, which is called Round Midnight, and a number of other things. But always that atmospheric guitar, whether you like Robert Fripp or Brian Eno or anything from that ilk from the late 70s, early 80s, that's definitely what he's done. But there's lots of feeling. It sometimes reminds you of movie soundtrack music. Very, very lush, very, very atmospheric, very, very evocative. You've been listening to some of it, and I'll be playing some of it while I do my interview with Andy Summers, because I got a chance to sit down with him to talk to him about having put together this documentary, what it was like for him to do revisit that, what music means to him, and quite a number of other things. It was a particular significance for me to interview Andy Summers because I had interviewed him before, long, long ago, actually 22 years ago when I first started here at BAI. Andy Summers, at the time, who was on Private Music doing solo albums. Private Music was a label that was started by Peter Bauman, formerly of Tangerine Dream. And this was in the late 80s, early 90s, during the time when New Age music was gaining a lot of popularity and becoming a legitimate genre. And a number of artists who had been in groups, especially big super groups from the 60s and 70s, were getting a chance to do their own solo recordings. Artists like Andy Summers, Jerry Goodman, Leo Kottke, Eddie Jobson, Patrick O'Hearn, a number of other artists who are on the Private Music label. They are, if you're ever interested, great albums to get. They're probably still available, probably somewhere on iTunes or somewhere, but I'd recommend them. But Andy Summers in particular had a number of albums that I really enjoyed, so we get the chance to speak about all of that here on Night Shift, here on listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. Well, you tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm here with the great Andy Summers. Andy?
Good to be here.
Well, Andy, it's been 22 years since I last sat down with you.
Amazing.
And at the time I was interviewing you about...
I'm only 23 years old.
I know. Well, you were young. It was your baby album. And it was for Charming Snakes.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I've loved what you did as an individual artist and the explorations you did. Mm. And I have very vivid memories of, you know, that music and what it meant to me at the time. Mm. So my first question to you is, when did you first know that music was going to be your life?
I think really probably when I was given the guitar. You know, I'd had piano lessons before that, and there's definitely something about music, but I, you know, I'm talking about 8, 9, 10 years old. That, you know, a life as a musician, I didn't think that. When I got the guitar at about 12 and a half years old, it was like destiny right there, right in my hands. You know, that I never looked up from that guitar again, and still haven't, basically. You know, that was it for me. I knew that I was a guitarist, you know, almost instantly. I got that thing. I didn't go, oh, I don't really want to play it today. I couldn't get off it. You know, it's just 10 hours a day from then on. So that was really the moment for me, I think.
Now, what was the moment when you said, wow, I really can play, I really can be a musician? Was there that watershed moment?
Yeah, I think probably, you know, again, early years, you know, like 14, 15, and I started to play with other people. And, you know, I was good at it. I was good at it, you know. I mean, you know, by the time I was 16, you know, I could play all of Wes Montgomery's solo on West Coast Blues. And I thought, you know, man... I don't know what I said to myself. Except I was trying at that age to do these things, play these complex things, and I was doing it because I fairly rapidly moved through, you know, just copying or like playing things like The Shadows and the first few chords, and I got into jazz because the inspiring thing was, to me, was American jazz, and the coolest, hippest, most rebellious guys were the American jazz musicians. You know, I mean, I was looking at like Miles and Thelonious and Coltrane and, yeah, the jazz, Wes Montgomery, of course, Kenny Burrell, you know, New York seemed like an incredibly legendary place. All the stuff was so exotic to a kid growing up in suburban England. And so my aspirations, not only with the instrument, but the way I wanted to look and everything, were all like from America. So,
well, yeah. I have another contextual question before I get specific to the documentary. I mean, there is a great, artistically, it's great to collaborate. And it's great to be part of something, but also creatively being able to tell your own stories, do your own music. And in the case of your solo work, which, like I said, impacted me so strongly, I always felt you were telling stories.
Yeah.
You know, even your titles were
you know,
intriguing. So tell me about being a storyteller and being able to convey what you're feeling, what you're thinking through music, what that means for you.
This is a really great question because maybe I am a storyteller, but I never thought of it quite like, oh, I never came to this, hey, I'm a storyteller. Oh. You know, it's just the way it comes out that I'm trying to let something unfold and bring the reader, the listener, in and come on this little journey with me, and we're going to go somewhere. And it may have a surprise ending, you know. Now that might be specific. Like I go to a key change or a chord at the end that's not part of it, and you go, "Whoa!"
Mm-hmm.
But that key change makes a statement about everything that was previous to it. You know, like you traveled across the country and you suddenly arrived in a very different terrain than you expected. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Hey, it's really cool.
Sure.
So, I think you're right. I mean, there's something about what I try to do, you know, whether it's writing lyrics or the way the chord structure or whatever else unfolds in a piece of music, that's what makes sense to me. I've played through all kinds of music in my life, and I've, you know, listened to everything. I pretty much know everything, but I find my taste is probably, you know, I try to make it anything I do, I have an edge and be fresh and be have something unexpected in it, and not necessarily be a generic piece of music. But I don't think I want to live on the fringes of the avant-garde, particularly.
Right.
And yeah, I don't want to be doing country, anything real cliche. So I always try to take, you know, I like harmonic music, but I try to twist it, always.
What I enjoyed was being able, especially with the instrumental music, and at that time, 20 years ago, and New Age and private music and all that, just the idea of music where it's not so much about the lyrics, where you can insert yourself,
for
me as a listener, in there and take some journey.
Well, that's absolutely true. One of the joys of instrumental music, because if you really ask me ultimately, I say I prefer music with no words, no singing, because I want to hear the music, I want to be in the music.
Ditto.
Yeah, you know, if you listen to classical music, you're listening to the music, you're listening to the composer's mind unfold this story. The minute you've got lyrics in there, then that's what you're really listening to. But it does become a complicated question. Oh, I'll get to that in a minute. But, you know, in that period of private music when I started to make these instrumental albums, and I was really exploring that, and you start to find out, what's your voice? You know, what are you going to do? And, you know, trying to make these kinky little tracks and do things and let the guitar become like the vocal line and to unfold a story. And certainly I've said, for years, like you said, I prefer instrumental music. Thank you.
right, Roxanne. You don't have to pull on the red light, Roxanne. You don't have to pull on the red light,
Roxanne. 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 Roxanne.
Difficulty in the modern world, of course, is going out without a singer. It's getting harder and harder because people want to hear a singer. People go, oh, music. Well, why is there no singing? Well, why don't you ask John Coltrane what was that singer? Oh, Mark,
thank
yeah,
you.
Come on.
Yeah, I feel old school now just to feel that way. Yeah. Well, you know, it's also interesting. I remember doing the interview with you. I remember, you know, of course, loving the albums before then. And I remember going to see you at Town Hall and just what I would call just a lack of pretension. It seemed to me the music was everything.
Yeah.
For you, and I'm just curious, in doing a documentary like this, going back and looking at your journey as an artist, but then also your musical journey, what was that like for you? Was it cathartic? Was it putting to rest certain things, or did it remind you maybe of who you were?
You mean going back and doing the police tour?
Sure.
I think that, you know, it's probably all of those things. You know, and there's probably some other things like, Jesus, how are we going to get through this? You know, how are we going to do this? You know, I know that I sort of, you know, we got to Vancouver and we're going to do a three weeks rehearsal, then we're going to do this. And I knew, like, we've got to keep this together, you know, because we'll never do this again. This is it, you know, this is it. We've really got to do this. And I know it's going to be really difficult. I'm sort of like praying to myself, do this. Don't get thrown. Don't walk out. Don't let the other two walk out. Like, how do we hold it? You know, just really hold this. And it was difficult. At the beginning, it was tense, you know, and there's that feeling like, oh, God, you know, we're all back together. All of us had thought we transcended and didn't want to be there. But you know what? They threw us back in the cage again. But it was already too late, because by the time we got to Vancouver, I mean, there were 120 people on the payroll. A lot of money had been spent. There was really no turning back. So, you know, you could throw your little tantrums. Man, you're doing this. So you better work it out. And we did slowly, you know, we made enough peace so that we could do it. Because I don't think we're naturally, you know, we have that very sparky chemistry that tends to blow you apart, blows it apart. It works in terms of like making exciting music, but it's difficult to stick around. So we worked it out, you know. We said, come on, you know, look what's going on out there every night. This is insane, you know. We've got to get through this. Complex. And
what made you want to do this documentary? What was the germ of the idea of actually doing it?
You know, I mean, I didn't write the book with the idea of, oh, it's going to be a film as well. I mean, it's sort of beyond your wildest dreams, like, we actually made a film. So, you know, I wrote the book, and that was a I suppose it had its moments of catharsis, you know, doing it, you know, because, I mean, there were literally moments when I was sitting in the room writing the book, and I go, I'm trying to be in this place, and I would play tracks or watch DVDs. Yeah. You know, just to kind of, the police, you know, like trying to be like a sense memory, like, right, trying to pull myself into the atmosphere of back then. But what really got me going on the idea of the thing was I saw this film called The Kid Stays in the Picture, which was made by his director, Brett Morgan, who was here in New York at the time. And I was, at the time I saw it, I was putting together this book for Taschen called I'll Be Watching You, which was all the photography I did in the police from day one till the end. And I was talking to the guys that I was doing it with, the computer guys. God, man, I saw this film. It's just so cool. It's just made out of still photographs and the guy's voiceover. And I, you know, Bob Evans, I reckon I could do that. But I don't know how to do it. And they said, well, Brett Morgan. So Brett Morgan at the time was some mythical figure to me. Like, I imagine some great old grand old. And he wasn't at all. He was a guy, 38-year-old guy living in New York. Anyway, as it happened, chance happened. I met somebody in L.A. who I had breakfast one day, a music supervisor, and talking about this, that, and the other. And I mentioned Brett Morgan. She said, oh, I know Brett, you know. You want to speak to him? I said, he'd love to hear from you. Oh. So suddenly, I don't know where this thing just dropped to my lap. She said, send him your stuff. Just call him up. Email him. She gave me his email. Contacted him. He said, I'd love to see him. Send him the stuff. He went, this is fantastic. I'd love to do this with you. You know, it's incredible how it works. So, anyway, we did meet. We got on well. He read the book. He saw all the photographs. We'll do this. And a few months later, as his space cleared, he had the time. We got together. We hooked up with another producer who worked with Nicolas Cage in Hollywood. And we went out to, like, see who was there. We sold it at the second meeting. You know, Yari bought it. You know, yeah, we didn't even have to try very hard. It's kind of incredible, actually. So all the right things came together at the same time. And I had this idea of making a film like that. But, of course, it evolved into other things. But we've got what we've got now. You know.
Well, I'm curious now. I tend to believe that your art defines you as you define your art.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, in this whole process of putting of the book, the documentary, what have you learned about yourself in this whole process?
That's a good question. What I learned about myself? I've learned that I can do these things. You just think that, crack out my man, it's like climbing Mount Everest. But I seem to have the ability to look at it and like come up with a methodology. Like I believe I've usually got the emotional resonance in me to do it. But, you know, it's like anything, you've got to kind of gear yourself. I know that I need to set aside time and put myself in a place like when I'm writing songs, a bunch of songs, like I just did this big Brazilian project and it's been quite a success. But to write all the songs for the girl, guys, don't talk to me, you know. I'm just going to write these songs now until I'll let you know when I'm done. And I put myself into that space. I have to kind of live it full on while I'm in that creative stage. You know, you're in the embryonic stage where all the stuff to come up, the right things to come in. And I know that I can do it, but I have to set my mind to it and do it, you know. That's the way I work. I prefer not to be doing too many things at once. I like to be really on one thing and go all the way with it.
Thank you.
That's been most interesting about your career is, and I've been wanting to ask you for a while, is what at this point what feeds your soul, what inspires you? You know, you mentioned this Brazilian project. You know, it's very different than other things you've done.
Yeah.
And musically, it's going to introduce you to different kinds of instrumentation, different kind of singer, different kind of thing. So what inspires you? What does it, you know, do you listen to new music? Do you go back to old, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of crap out there. You know, I should start listening. Like, man, it's so hard to find anything. You know, like people go, "Ooh, what rock bands are you listening to?" I go, "Not many, because most of them are crap, and I've heard it all before." You know, I don't find a lot, and I try. You know, I'm very gullible. I read it, and go, "Oh, God, that sounds great. I better get it." And I go, "What the?" You know, there's a couple of bands. I mean, I'll broaden this, but you know, like I've been listening to Grizzly Bear. Like Grizzly Bear, Brooklyn scene is good. I like the Dirty Projectors. Some interesting stuff coming out of there. You know, Grizzly Bear, not really a rock band per se, but the music they're doing is very nice. Yeah, I like that. You know, and who's that girl? That crazy semi-classical singer. It's also out of Brooklyn. Very interesting. Think of a name on it, but I, you know, the inspiration for things. It comes from odd places, I think. Mostly my inspiration is from the past, you know. I mean, it's usually, I still like a lot of old stuff that I like. There's a lot of classical guitar I like, you know, I grew up with that. I'd still list all the great jazz greats that I love so much all my life, you know. Everything of Miles, Coltrane, Monk, you know, I did a Monk album, I did a Mingus album. I was going to try and do a Miles one, which maybe I will do one day. You know, some of the, you know, the great jazz guitar players I grew up with as a kid, you know. Then, you know, because I deviated into Indian music for a bit. Brazilian music, big influence on me. So I was very happy to do. I play in Brazil every year since 1996. been there three times this year. So
wow.
The Brazilian thing's kind of big with me. I play there a lot. I just come back from a month in Brazil. So I'm spinning. I only got back 3 days ago.
Yes, I see the tan. You're getting close.
Yeah. Yeah, it was getting really warm down there as I left. But no, I was there for a month. I did a record with a girl called Fernanda Takai, who's in a band called Pato Fu. And she's pretty, really quite well known down there. And this record's been really quite successful, very well received. So I had a seven-piece Brazilian band down there. So that was kind of fun. Rehearsing in Rio and played all over the country.
Well, tell me now, to me, I think being a musician and being a photographer, film seems like a natural, you know, extension of those two things to put together. What did you think of the whole process? And what came to mind seeing the documentary is just the idea of image versus reality, front versus what's behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those type of themes, are those things that you considered putting this together? Were there things that you felt spoke for themselves, things that you, you know, were surprised to see or notice?
Well, yeah, clearly film is another medium and it's going to come across and tell the story in a different way than a book. You can't do every page of the book. You've got to, like, figure it out. I mean, luckily we've had an absolutely brilliant film editor, Andy Grieve, who has become the director, and very well deserved. But he's a real artist. He's a solo guy who did it solo in Brooklyn on his own, and he's a real artist. And he's made the film. Well, the material existed, and he obviously read the book and knows the story. But he was seeing it from an editor's point of view, which is different from me, more objective, and probably good, because I get caught up on all the little cherished, oh, what, you're not going to put that in? Oh, my God, I can't believe it. It's so great. Doesn't work.
Oh, God.
We've got to let it go. And then putting in some, like, cringy moments. Go, why are you putting that in? God, you know. Because it says something, you know. This kind of stuff. So he had a very good point of view on it and very clever. So I think you know, you're getting, yes, the outer idea is the successful band, we're touring the world, everybody's cheering. And then there's the behind-the-scenes stuff where you see, like, some of the tensions between us and, like... and then in the more overall story of me, my life, you know, you see the down moments where I get really can lose everything. In living in L.A., get down to nothing. Later on, we get divorced. So, you know, within the success and all that, there's all this other stuff that happens. You know, in fact, all three of us got divorced. Yeah, as it happens, you know. So, you know, what I like about the film is that I think it's not sanitized in any way. It tells the story, as did the book. It's sort of straightforward, and there's the difficulties in it as well.
Now, I have to ask, were there any hard feelings as a result of the book or the movie, or does everybody at this point comfortable with who they are?
No, thank you. Sorry to bother you. This is the fifth time they've come. God.
I was asking, were there any hard feelings?
No. Comfortable with both singers, you were very complimentary about the book. They both were very nice about it. Sting called me and said, I read the book, you know, about 3 days of it coming out. Great. And he said, that's hilarious. I really like it. So, you know, very pleasing, because you don't know. I tried to be fair in the book, but I tried to tell the truth. And the same thing in the film. Stuart saw the film and called me, emailed me immediately and said, I saw your film. I didn't even know he'd got it. I don't know how he got it, but he was very complimentary about it. I don't know if Sting's seen it. We sent it to his manager. He may have seen it or not. I don't know. But we don't usually stand in the way for each other's things. It's like, why are you doing that? But actually, everybody gets to do whatever they want.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And the reaction you've gotten to the documentary from fans, from people who knew your music, people who maybe only knew the Police, how has that been? How rewarding has it been?
The reaction from
just people who have seen the film from festivals or whatever.
Well, is this premiere tonight?
Oh, this is it. So no one's seen it.
No.
Oh, wow.
We're brand new.
You're one of a handful of people. We've only been very judicious about sending it out to the press.
Okay.
No. Very few people seen it.
I need to interview you again after now.
Yeah, we'll have to talk again.
Yeah, no, <pause. laughs>
Well, then I guess my last question is, what can your fans here in America expect next? What's the next record that we can get? You mentioned the Brazilian record.
Well, that's what. Yeah, that's out. That was out in Brazil. I don't know if it's going to make it in the States.
And what's the title of the album?
It's called Fundamental. Very nice record. I'll get you one. The next record is, I have a band, a new band, which I've been working on. This is the next project. It's called Circa Zero. That's the band. And we played a track on radio this morning, which went down very well. We're just about finished with the record. I've been working up with a great singer called Rob Giles. He's in a band called The Rescues, which have pretty much disbanded now. But we've worked on that since February. Rock. Great singer, great. The songs are great. I'm very pleased with it. So we're going to be launching that in the next, literally in the next few weeks.
Well, I hope to get to play that too.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Andy.
Great. It was great to. It's always been so hard. Thank you.
That was a past episode of Night Shift featuring an interview with Andy Summers. It was sort of the return of Andy Summers because I'd interviewed him way, way, way back in the day. And yeah, it is wild. It's wild to Danny says we had the echo thing happening. We have the echo
thing.
Oh, he
can hear us in echo?
He can hear us in echo. I don't know why. He can hear an echo thing. Well, it makes us sound like gods. Okay, you're listening to Night Shift. We're broadcasting on high. All right, so you are still tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. I'm Mike Sargent. I'm here with MFJ. Danny is here in the virtual time that we do this. We're doing this in a virtual time, live to digital. Live to the cloud, live somewhere. Somewhere in some way we are live and someone's listening other than ourselves. It could be Danny. It says one elsewhere. So, it is Danny. Danny, he's identified himself. Danny is still listening. Danny, wherever he is, whatever planet, he may be floating out into the ionosphere right now, for all we know. But he's still listening. He was listening in the trenches, and now he could be listening in the ethers. Okay? Now, you know. Oh, please. Danny's got you beat in so many ways. All right, but let me just ask you, because we didn't talk about it, we would have talked about it on the show. I want to ask you your thoughts on George Miller, and I want to ask you your thoughts on Bill Nighy, but. What do you think about the fact that, you know, there's a division now for all the UFO? I wish Danny was here. Danny, I want to know what you think about the fact that there's a division for all the UFO stuff within the government. Official division in the UFOs. And what, by the way, one of the conspiracy theories about the raid was like they needed to get the alien stuff. Yes, I love that. I love that. Yes, that's good. That's really good. Yes. You know, Trump had the alien documents. They had to get it back. They can't say anything. All right. Anyway. So what's your thought?
He's like, I want to read this.
No. So what's your thought on the whole UFO thing? You felt it was inevitable? What's your take?
I thought it was like the show became real. And
the show became real? What do you mean the show? You mean Night Shift. Okay. The show.
When I started listening to Night Shift, it was like
real.
Almost like the news commentary on sort of current X-Files.
Sort of pointing out the surreality of reality.
Right. But almost still in an abstract. You could talk to, like, you had Richard C. Hoagland on talking about Monuments on Mars, but there's still, you know, but then you could still have a lot of people that just sort of roll their eyes like, oh, come on. Now, today, 2022, it's everything is ridiculous.
The next show, the next vintage encore presentation from the 30 years of Night Shift is an interview that I did with George Miller at the time for Happy Feet 2, and an interview I did with Bill Nighy for a Christmas film he had done called Arthur Christmas. So tell me what's your thought on George Miller? What's your thought on Bill Nighy? Are you a fan of both?
I am very much a fan of both. I'm trying to remember the first time I really sort of became aware of who Bill Nighy was. I almost want to say the zombie comedy, Shaun of the Dead. But it has to be before that. But it's also kind of interesting that he found stardom,
I guess, at a much older age. I'm always sort of interested in actors that are a bit older and just all of a sudden they hit it.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I love Bill Nighy too. I think I probably saw him in a few things, and I saw him earlier than I even saw him in Underworld when he played like the top vampire. You remember that? He was great. But you know, it was Love Actually, when you realize, wow, Bill Nighy's great. So Love Actually is really the movie that really kind of made it work for me. You're about to hear a vintage Night Shift episode from over 10 years ago, where there's an interview with George Miller, who is the director and creator of Mad Max, the Mad Max movies, and has a new film coming out called 3,000 Years of Longing that we're not talking about, but this is when he did Happy Feet 2. He did Happy Feet and Happy Feet 2. He's a great director. He's really interesting.
Might you interview him again?
What's that? You know, that's a really good question. I have to say, like I said earlier, I did a lot of interviews on Night Shift. A lot. I spoke to everybody. Who did I not speak to? I played the Francis Ford Coppola a couple of weeks ago for like, and only half of the interview. So anyway, we've spoken to everybody here on Night Shift, and so you should listen and enjoy. And if you're enjoying the show, please consider making a pledge. You can call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Sounds so familiar, doesn't it? Mike from Jersey. And make a pledge in the name of Night Shift for WBAI.
Looking out the window, I see the red dust clear. High up on the red rock stands the shadow with the spear. Land here is strong, strong beneath my feet. It feeds on the blood, it feeds on the heat. The rhythm is below me, the rhythm is around me, the rhythm is inside me.
Thank you. past the guns, raising them up high, held open to the sun. Self-conscious, uncertain, I'm showered with the dust, but the spirit enters into me, and I submit to trust. Smash the radio.
No outside voices here.
Smash the watch.
Can I tear the day to shreds?
Smash the camera.
Can I steal away spirits?
The rhythm is around me. The rhythm has control. The rhythm is inside me.
Heard in the beginning is the brilliant, of course, Peter Gabriel from his new album, New Blood, where he reinterprets classically and orchestrally a number of his most famous and clearly most moving pieces. Rhythm of the Heat is one of my favorite pieces, and he does that in San Jacinto and Red Rain. I'll get to some of that in here. It's just absolutely amazing. It's fantastic and very cinematic. But speaking of cinema, I have a special episode of Night Shift this evening, or this morning, depending how you want to look at it, where I'm going to be playing some interviews I've been doing over the last few weeks while we were in Marathon. Last week I started to do my Harry Potter coverage, and that got interrupted by the Deoccupy Wall Street, as it happened, and we were the only ones covering it live for over an hour, even though, mysteriously, media was there. And arrived with the police, but didn't report. Anyway, there are a number of films that are out right now, a number of films that are in theaters, and we're in that season that's known as the Oscar season. This is the time of year when the studios release usually their best. There's always some counter-programming, like kids' films and Christmas-themed movies and things like Twilight for the stuff that the more adult fare that's coming out now, the stuff that would appeal more to a different audience. But this is when a lot of really good movies come out. And there are a number of them that are out, and there are a number of them I'm going to talk to you about in the review. First movie I'm going to talk about is a movie called Happy Feet 2. Happy Feet 2 is directed by George Miller. Now, for those of you who don't know who George Miller is, George Miller is the writer-director out of Australia who created the Mad Max series. He did Mad Max, The Road Warrior, and then Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Then he didn't do too much. He went ahead and did a segment in that ill-fated Twilight Zone movie. And then he made a huge comeback with a film called Babe, which some of you may remember. And at the time, it was definitely a departure from the action, violent, adult things he was doing to do this family movie utilizing really some of the latest technology and having a pig as the star. And that was a huge hit for him. Then a few years back, he did a movie called Happy Feet. And Happy Feet was unique for several reasons. Not only was it, again, George Miller doing something you wouldn't expect him to do in that it was computer animation, but Happy Feet utilized motion capture for the animation so that the dancing that Happy Feet does is actually performed by Savion Glover, who's a famous dancer and choreographer and performer on Broadway as well. And so Happy Feet, when Happy Feet dances, it's Savion Glover, but the other unique thing about Happy Feet is that it was utilizing for the soundtrack something that was just beginning to catch on. Two things. One, the mashup, which is where you take more than one song, at least two, and they may not seem like they go together, but they do, and they wedge them into each other and become one whole new song. Sometimes it could be up to a half a dozen songs. And just the redoing of classic songs, which has become very uber popular with Glee. So Happy Feet was a little bit of a, you know, ahead of its time at that time. It did very well and even won him an Oscar for Best Animated Film. Well, he's come back with Happy Feet 2. And I got a chance to talk to him about doing Happy Feet 2, why he's making the moves he's making in his career, and a little bit about the long-rumored reboot of Road Warrior. So, stay tuned. I'm Mike Sargent, and you are tuned to Night Shift here on Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI. I'm going to talk with George Miller about Happy Feet 2. George Miller, how are you?
Well, thank you.
Okay. Well, it's been a couple of years. I interviewed you for the last Happy Feet.
I remember.
You do? All right. Well, I'm African American.
Sitting in the same room, I think.
Yes, we were. And if I weren't flying out of town this afternoon, I'd be there now. Well, I have to say, at the time when you did Happy Feet, you know, we talked about a lot of the reasons why you wanted to do it. And you even kind of hinted at the fact that you would do another one if you had the opportunity. So tell me a little bit about what, not only, you know, I'm sure economics have something to do with it, but what made you feel that there was more you could and wanted to say by doing a second film?
Well, you know, these animations take a long time, 4 years in the case of the first one. And as I saw the film emerging and saw what the technology could do, and more particularly as I got to know the characters, they kind of live like imaginary friends in your head. And it's not hard to think of what, you know, to speculate what would happen if, and so on. And so probably in the last year of Happy Feet, there was, you know, there was distinct, you know, there was a kind of a, almost a frustration and need to sort of, oh, we could have done that. Oh, the technology could have done this. There was, even like 3D, we'd rendered the three of the scenes of Happy Feet 1 in 3D, and they look wonderful. I mean, it's such a spectacular landscape, and the characters, they were very palpable, the furry, particularly the furry characters. You wanted to reach out and touch them, but we just didn't have the bandwidth or the budget or the time to do it. So I thought, you know, all those things sort of, it was like a chance to do it again, and so that was pretty, I almost didn't have a choice.
Well, you know, it's interesting because all of your films, to me, there is a strong social context. And there, you know, for me, I love science fiction. One of the reasons I love science fiction is that it always has something to say about the human condition. And I think in these films, under all the music and under all of the fun and the cute creatures and everything, there is something to say, both about a coexistence between humans and animals, and, you know, what can and cannot be prevented or done if, you know, you really want it to be done. So what were some of the themes now that you really felt were important that you wanted to say?
Well, probably the overriding one was that that when we come together despite all the things that keep us apart, we can overcome the problems of a chaotic world.
Mm.
I mean, if you look at this film, everyone begins the film apart. The father mumbles from his son, Eric. Mumble and Gloria are physically apart. The two krill are separated. Sven, the Hank Azaria character, is taken out of his own world. Mumble and he, you know, has this issue with the beachmaster, the big elephant seal. But when finally they all come together with some common purpose, then they're able to overcome the big problems. And to be honest, despite all the terrible things we see in the news and the headlines and so on, it's when I think we as humankind are at our best, when we're able to do that. There's plenty of examples where we see that happening, and I think we're quite magnificent when that does happen.
Sure, I agree 1,000%. Well, one of the other themes that I thought for me all the characters went through was gaining perspective of the krill as to what they are, from the father, you know, the son, everybody, every character ends up gaining a different perspective and being able to change what they do.
That's fabulous. That never occurred to me. Absolutely true. Yeah, the krill, you know, Will in particular, and mm-hmm. Bill, and then you know, Eric sees his father.
Definitely.
Yeah, who he is, and his father sees his son for who he is.
Exactly.
That's wonderful.
Well, I'm curious for you, in making a film like this, considering, you know, all the successes you've had and the different, you know, you're almost like a pop singer. You've reinvented yourself a number of times. You know, I was speaking to someone yesterday, and I was talking about the film, and I mentioned, yeah, this is the same director as, you know, the Mad Max. They're like, what? They couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And then I mentioned, yeah, and he did Babe. What? So that was a reaction, and I'm curious. I kind of believe that your art defines you as you define your art. What did you learn about yourself in the making of this, and what do you get out of doing films that reach children as opposed, and adults, but children specifically? Is there something you get out of that that's maybe more satisfying even than adult films?
Well,
I know that's a two-part question.
Yeah, the first part, what appears to be, you know, a pretty eccentric mix of things. Basically, I'm very much driven by story. I like to, you know, I like the writing process, and the big thing I think that drives me is not only how to tell a good story, but why do we tell each other stories? Clearly, we're hardwired for narrative. We need somehow to see the world coherently through our stories, and most of all, we do that when we're young. If you look at our nursery rhymes and fairy tales,
sure,
a lot of subtext and learning. You know, take Hansel and Gretel. You know, it's parents trying to get rid of, you know, their kids. I mean, that's pretty confronting stuff. And
yeah,
the kids have to learn to be resourceful and courageous, and they get seduced by the gingerbread house and eat too much candy and all of that. So there's a little sort of micro moral adventure in all of that. And having kids, you know, myself, you realize that it's through stories that they most learn to negotiate life.
Sure.
Even family stories, you know, you talk about your own experiences of life, and so I think I got into kids films, you know, at the time that I had kids myself,
hmm.
and, So I think there's a real responsibility in that. I think it is. I've come to realize in any form of storytelling, whether you're a journalist or a novelist or a musician or any form of communication, or even there's a responsibility if you're writing little stories on Twitter. I think
sure
that it can have an impact, and you know you've got to be mindful and respectful of that. So I guess in the first place, what drives me is story, and secondly, it's I feel a strong sense that we can get a lot out of these sort of fables, like the Happy Feet. You know, it brings out the child in the adult, and the adult in the child. As I heard someone once say, when you're an adult, it sort of takes you back to the experience of childhood in a way when you watch these films, and a child can learn to grow up a little bit.
I agree. Well, I could easily talk to you for a while. I guess I have time for one last question.
Yes.
When did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
I grew up with my twin brother in a rural community, and I guess we had most of our day was spent in play out in the bush, and I remember we would always be telling each other stories. I wasn't aware I wanted to be a storyteller, I just felt I was at that point. But then when I actually started to make film, I was mainly interested in the kinetic form of film. I was very interested in how bits of film came together to just create a narrative. And then after the first Mad Max, I suddenly realized, wow, here's a story we made. It was a very low-budget movie, $350,000, and I didn't think it would be seen by many people, and it went out around the world, and I suddenly saw, oh, this means something to people. This people take something from this stuff. And then that sort of started it. And then I became much, much more interested in storytelling, and particularly when I started to sort of read Joseph Campbell and saw, you know, the function of story in all cultures, that I realized, oops, there's a kind of a sacred responsibility here. I'd better pay attention.
Hmm. Well, I easily have many more questions for you, but I thank you for this time. I know they're going to interrupt you any second. And what's next?
Well, we were gearing up to shoot a Mad Max earlier this year, and then unprecedented rains turned the center of Australia into a flower garden. So it was postponed a year, and we're going to be shooting that next in Namibia now, because the rains haven't stopped.
Do you know what you'd bring to it now, having lived another 25 years in between, that you wouldn't?
Something more interesting. That remains to be seen.
Okay. Well, thank you, George Miller.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thick cloud, steam rising, hissing stone on sweat lodge fire. Around me, buffalo robe, sage and bundle, rub on skin. Outside, cold air, stand and wait for rising sun. Red paint, eagle feathers, coyote calling, it has begun. Something moving in, tasted in my mouth and in my heart. It feels like dying slow. Thank you. Medicine man, lead me up through town. Indian ground, so far down. Cut up land, each house a book. Kids wearing water wings, drinking cool. Follow dry riverbed. Watch scouts and guides make powwow signs. Pasture on a most disco. Sitting bull steakhouse. White men dream. Rattle in the old man's taxi. Look at mountain top. Keep climbing up. Way above us the desert snow. White wind blows.
Thank you.
that was just fantastic. That's all I can say. It was fantastic. But that was Peter Gabriel from the album New Blood, where he reinterprets old songs that he's written, which actually, when you hear the lyrics stripped bare without the instrumentation he originally had, they actually take on new and deeper meaning. That was a great, great, one of my favorite Peter Gabriel songs of all time, called San Jacinto. You have to, if you go online, you get to see him talking. I was going to play some of it on the show if I have time, him talking about how he came up with each of these pieces. The original inspiration for the song is pretty amazing. But getting back to the movies and movies that are in theaters, another film that's out, and I will say, in terms of my review for Happy Feet 2, I think Happy Feet 2 is actually better than Happy Feet 1. I think it's a little more emotionally involving, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the music more. And as opposed to relying on the gimmick, they really had a story, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was fun. Another movie that's out, actually coming out this weekend, that's not out yet in wide release, is a film called Arthur Christmas. Now, Arthur Christmas might be a film that you might want to not pay attention to until you realize it's from Aardman. And Aardman is the animation company that does all the Wallace and Gromit. And if you like Wallace and Gromit, you'll understand the humor, the intelligence, the just the fun. It's really funny. It's very unique. It's a unique story. It's not like what any other animation studio would do, whether it's Pixar or DreamWorks or any of the others. They have their own thing. They do their own thing their own way. The premise behind Arthur Christmas, as you've probably seen in the trailers, is what kind of an operation would Santa have to be able to deliver 8 billion toys in like 8 hours? And so it really jumps from there, and then what kind of family would he have, and how long do you live to be Santa, and Santa's family, and it's really a surprisingly funny and enjoyable, moving, it's just a great family film, much better than I would have expected. And very often I don't, as a film critic now, I don't watch trailers, and I read very little about the films. I just go and let myself be taken somewhere, and this is a movie that definitely will take you somewhere. It's got its own concept, and it takes you there, and it's a lot of fun. I got a chance to talk to two people involved with the film, the writer-director Sarah Smith and Bill Nighy, who plays old Santa, Grandpa Santa. Bill Nighy's just a great actor. He's been great in everything from the Underworld films to so many great British films to Love Actually. He's even in the last two Harry Potters. He's the Minister of Magic. But Bill Nighy's a great actor. But I get a chance to speak to both Bill Nighy and Sarah Smith about Arthur Christmas, and it's worth listening to. And the film is definitely worth seeing. I'll be back after those interviews and have some more music for you. There's some great music that Peter Gabriel has on New Blood, but there's also a great, great score for a film that's coming out called Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I got a chance to speak with the director of that, but I won't be playing that this week. But yes, you are tuned, still tuned, to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. This is Still Night Shift. Up next, Sarah Smith, writer-director of Arthur Christmas, then Bill Nighy, Grandpa Santa, and Arthur Christmas.
All right, you're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm here with Sarah Smith, who is the writer-director of the new film, Arthur Christmas. Sarah, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you very much.
So, here's my first question. When did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
Wow, that's an amazing question. You know, when I was about 5 in the bath, I always used to say I wanted to be a writer or a conductor. And I guess that being a director is somewhere between the two.
That's true. And when did you first know you could tell stories?
Well, my background actually was in comedy in the UK, in radio and in television. But over all of the work I did a lot of short films, you know, sketch shows and satires and so on. But I was always the one trying to get a big picture in there, trying to get a big story. And I just fell in love with big emotional storytelling during that time, even though not all, you know, a lot of the material I did, people always tell me I did dark, edgy comedy. Maybe didn't reflect that. But for me, animation was an opportunity to kind of let rip with a big emotional story.
Okay, and what was the initial germ of the idea for Arthur Christmas?
The idea came to me from my very long-term friend and collaborator, Pete Bainham, and he had the genius notion of what it would actually take for Santa in this day and age, in our real modern world, to deliver 2 billion presents to 650 million children in 10 hours, and came up with the idea that you would need some gigantic military-style secret covert operation of crack elves. And he had the second idea that in this middle of this mission, something would go wrong, and that Santa had this kind of idiot son who had to go and try and put it right. And those two ideas, immediately you feel you start to see a movie.
Sure. Now, let me ask you, when you're writing, okay, and I kind of believe a movie is directed three times. First time when you write it, second time when you're actually producing it, third time when you're directing, when you're editing. Mm. So in case of this, because it's animation and the shooting and the editing kind of go together, you see how things work. When you first wrote, did you have any idea for the casting? Did you know what they sound like? Did you do the voices yourselves?
Yeah, I did some of the voices, but also I used a team of kind of friendly actors that I knew to do an entire reading of the movie over a couple of days. We recorded it like a radio play in order to give the storyboard artists, you know, some good performances to inspire their drawings. I agree with you about directing a movie three times, but in a way, I always like the idea of writing a script and then handing it over. But as I'm writing it, I'm trying to direct it on the page, and by the time I've done that, you know, by saying, and we see, and I'm already thinking of what the shots would be, I kind of can't bear to let it go. And animation is also unusual in that you edit it really before you make it.
That's
because
what I
mean. There's no opportunity for waste. And I loved that process because I feel very comfortable. I often feel that shooting live action is like war. You know, you go out there and it's really what you can achieve given that it's going to start to rain and that the actor doesn't like the idea that you have for what you want him to do. You know, there's just a million different things that you're trying to deal with, and you come back with what you can achieve in those circumstances and then try and edit it into the thing you imagined. And by that time, it's usually something very different. In animation, you actually edit your storyboards into the movie that you see in your head, and then you get a chance to try and make that.
Okay. Well, another thing, and I'll reveal to you, I'm a film critic for WBAM, and I'm also a filmmaker. So I know very often when you write something, you may have the original idea, but as you get into it, you start finding, there's all these other things you want to say. Did that happen at all in this? Were there other things you found you wanted to address or bring up or allude to?
Yeah, absolutely. I once had a very wise talk by Andrew Stanton at Pixar saying it's a bit like excavating bones. You think you found the skeleton, you know what it is, and then you suddenly find another bone, and you have to completely realize that you're looking at a totally different animal from what you thought. And that's a very good analogy. I think with us, we always had the idea that Arthur would have this very pure passion for the idea that this one kid who didn't have a gift was incredibly important and mattered as much as all children put together. But I think one of the things which Sony led us to was enriching the family relationships so that Arthur's own family and his situation in his own family is also as important in the movie.
What about the challenge, and or is it a challenge maybe that you just have a philosophy on it? One of the things about doing something that's comedy, it's funny when you wrote it.
Mm.
It's funny when the actor says it.
Mm.
It's funny when you first drew it. But after a while, you have no idea if that's funny anymore. So tell me about keeping that.
That's a really, really good point. And I think in animation, that's an incredibly... I think that's a really incredibly tough thing because it goes on for 4 or 5 years. And they're definitely was a moment in the middle of the making of the movie where we were suddenly like, none of it's funny anymore. And I think the truth is some of it always was, but some of it, because it takes such a long time, it is possible to lose a little bit of the spark along the way. And we were fortunate enough to have an opportunity to revisit some of those moments and kind of just fight the spark back in them again. And it wasn't that we radically changed them. We just remembered what was supposed to be funny about them and brought it back again.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I enjoyed it. All right, you're tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI, and I'm here with Bill Nighy, who plays Grand Santa in the new film Arthur Christmas. Bill, welcome to BAI.
Thank you.
So I'm curious, having done film, theater, doing voiceover work, what do you find yourself drawing upon? Are there things that you've, you know, television, you know, where do you, what do you find and what do you get out of doing it that you couldn't do maybe in one of the other mediums?
Well, when I started out, I did a lot of work. My apprenticeship really was on BBC Radio. And it saved my bacon because, you know, when you start out, you've got no money. And the only people that gave me any work were BBC Radio. And the other great thing about it is, as with animations, is that you get to play parts that you would never get to play normally. And in those terms, they would give me leading roles that no one else was going to give me when I was young. But also, you get to play a range of parts. Like with animations, I can play Grand Santa, who's 136 years old and doesn't have any hair and doesn't have any teeth. Because, you know, it's a character. It's a cartoon character. And it is interesting. I like doing it because everything is concentrated in the voice. But I think the references for it, for whatever noises you make, do come from everything you've ever heard. I don't have any specific ones. There isn't anything I can say I based it on. But you know that you're going into the memory banks of other performances. And what I was trying to avoid was anything I'd ever heard before. I was primarily trying to avoid anything that I'd ever done before,
sure.
And then trying to avoid anything that I'd heard in a movie. I wanted it to be kind of original to this film.
Well, I think you definitely created an original character, and I didn't at any time think, oh, Bill Nighy, you know. And my background clearly is in radio, but I started out doing radio drama.
Right.
So I'm curious, radio drama in general in terms of the exercises and... Was that, or how did that ever help you with things you did later on?
I can't overstate the importance of my radio career when I was young. And I still do radio in England. I do all the time. I've never stopped. I love the radio. As a listener, I love the radio.
So do I.
Because it's just a unique experience. I love I've never gotten over the phenomenon of it. I love listening to plays on the radio. The great thing about it was the fact that I got to be in close proximity to seriously good actors, older actors, men and women who were brilliant, and I do believe that by osmosis you absorb some of their experience, you know. And I did play after play after play after play. Every time you finished a play, they'd say, what are you doing next week? And you'd go, nothing. They go, right, you know. And apart from giving you money when you haven't got any money, it was invaluable experience. And the fact that you have to concentrate everything into your voice
mm-hmm.
is incredibly good training. It's incredibly good preparation for when you then go out. It gives you a commitment to your voice, a kind of, you explore your voice and the possibilities of your voice in a way that you would never do if you had to concern yourself with how you look and the visuals and all of that thing. The fact that it's done to the exclusion of everything else really, really helps you, because I think if you, you know, it's like when, because if you haven't, well, I don't know what the, you know, if you haven't arrived in your voice as a young man, then you're in serious trouble. And a lot of people haven't because of their cultural background. They try and shift it around. They change it a little bit. And some people just haven't, so they're not, they don't kind of live in their voice. Their voice doesn't represent them in some strange way. Radio gave me a chance to kind of focus it and to find out what it can do and also what I'm personally supposed to sound like. You know, what's my voice? Because your voice is a series of choices.
Oh,
I mean, obviously your background and you know where you come from and everything mm-hmm. governs it to some degree. But it was invaluable to me, and I treasure the radio. And you know, I mean, if they ever do anything in England to BBC Radio 4, I'm going to leave the country.
I understand that. Well, I have to say, you actually answered a bunch of questions, because I always felt your. One of the things I love about is the way you kind of savor the words and the way you will have a character say whatever it is. And I'm curious, in a character like Grandpa Santa, which you said you wanted to make him like nothing else, where do you change where your voice comes from, how it sounds? I know myself, having done radio, like you said, you do yeah. find like how you sound best on mic, where...
Yeah.
You know, what
yeah.
will work.
Yeah. Well, I did. I screwed myself up to some degree, and I did get the voice does come from a slightly different place. In the end, you just do what you did when you were a kid. And it's all extensions of that. It's not rocket science, and you either have a touch for it or you don't. But, you look at the drawings of a 136-year-old man with no hair, no teeth, and a stick. and you think, well, what kind of sound would come out of that thing, you know? So in the end, it's a leap of imagination, and the first few times it's embarrassing, and the director goes, well, no, not quite, that's not exactly what I had in mind, and then eventually you arrive at something. But yeah, and I think if there were a video of me recording, you'd probably see me trying to screw my body up into a sort of 136-year-old man in some way. And I hope there isn't a video, because it won't, you know, I won't be looking my best.
Well, let me ask you, considering you were telling me you started in radio, when did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
Well, originally I wanted to be a writer. My great, like everybody, who was I reading the other day who said... I was reading, I think, Martin Amis the other day, who said, you know, everybody wants to be a writer when they're 15. I mean, you know, most people think, oh, I could tell stories, I'd be really good at that, you know. And I wanted to be a writer. And then the acting thing, I did a bit of acting at school, but that didn't really set me on fire. But it was subsequently, I knew I didn't want to, I knew that I wanted to express myself in some way other than a regular job. I mean, everybody feels that, and I was lucky that I met someone who encouraged me to go to drama college, acting college, and it took me a while to accept myself as someone who was allowed to be an actor. I don't come from a background where there were any actors. There was no precedent for it. Nobody around our way was anything like an actor. You just got a regular job and, you know, and got on with it. So it took me a little while. I used to hitchhike all around England to go to different gigs. And you'd get in the car, they'd say, where are you going? I'd say, I'm going to Liverpool. They'd say, what are you going to be doing there? And I would lie. I wouldn't say, I'm going to the theatre. I'm going to be an actor. Because I didn't feel I could say, I'm an actor. You know, I didn't feel like... I thought I'd be kind of lying if I said that. And if I did say I was working in the theatre, I used to say I'm a stage electrician. I used to say, I paint the set. You know, I work backstage, because I felt that was really where my place. You know, and I did do a lot of that when you were young. You used to paint the set and do all that stuff. Anyway, this is I'm rambling a touch, but it took me a while, and then it was. And what I love is the writing and the words. And I love it when people can really write dialogue. Writing dialogue is that's any good is extremely rare in any genre. It's kind of, you know, and then I got really lucky, and I started to work with very good writers, and there were a couple of roles. I worked with David Hare a great deal. I just recently did a thing that was on Masterpiece called Page 8. We're going to make two more of those next year. And I worked with Brian Friel, who's an Irish playwright. You know, and the whole challenge of delivering great writing, that's when I turned pro. I kind of got interested, and it was through the writing, really. And also because I was lucky enough to do a couple of things that where you got to say all the stuff that you were currently thinking. It was just lucky. It was just a coincidence that you got to speak out loud in front of a lot of people ideas which you personally held, you know, and approved of. And that was thrilling. And it also was contemporary. It was to do with contemporary issues. So you felt like you were contributing in some way. But the whole technical thing of being an actor is, you know, I mean, you have to deal with your self-consciousness. I was chronically self-conscious. I used to stand very still on stages, having conversations with myself, which went something like, move your left hand. I can't move my left hand. Don't be in it. Move your left hand. Excuse my language. You can beep it out. Move across this. I can't move. Yes, you can. Just move. Be normal. Take the weight off your left leg. What are you talking about? You know, all that stuff. What do I do with my hands? And young actors, you know, I had a young actor recently saying, do you know what? My problem is I don't know what to do with my hands when I'm on stage. And I said, well, do you know what? The only thing I know about that is you're not supposed to know what to do with your hands. It doesn't make you a bad person if you don't know what to do with your hands. You just have to learn how to, you know, deceive yourself and the audience. But anyway, I don't know if that goes anywhere.
Oh, no,
you
definitely answered the question. Well, I don't have more time, but
okay.
Thank you very much. I continue to enjoy you.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you, Mike.
You are still tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. If you've been enjoying this episode of Night Shift, which is a celebration.